TBRI.
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 TOVD.
TBRI.
TBRI, Trust-Based Relational Intervention.
TBRI is an attachment-based
trauma-informed intervention
that is designed to meet the complex needs
of vulnerable children.
TBRI uses empowering principles
to address physical needs,
connecting principles for attachment needs,
and correcting principles to disarm fear-based behaviors.
While TBRI is based on years of attachment, sensory processing, and neuroscience research,
the heartbeat of TBRI is connection.
Hello and welcome to the TBRI podcast. You're listening to Season 5, Episode 6. On this show, we talk all about TBRI, or Trust-Based Relational Intervention. We talk about different elements of the model itself, and also about how TBRI is applied in various communities of care and practice. Our guest today is Becky Lloyd, founder and director of Science for Hope. Since it was established in 2009, Science for Hope has evolved into an all-encompassing ministry of adoption surrounding deaf children. Our host, Sarah Mercado, sat down with Becky to talk about her work with Science for Hope and about how TBRI is adapted when working with the deaf community. Whether you are a hearing parent of a deaf child, a deaf parent of a deaf child, a professional working with deaf children, or someone who just wants to learn more about best practices in adoption of deaf children, there is something for you in this conversation today. We are also pleased to announce that we will begin offering transcripts of our podcast episodes. Links to transcripts will appear in the show notes of each episode and also on our website, child.tcu.edu. We will start at season one and work our way up to season five, so give us a few weeks to get the transcripts for this episode and others in season five up and running. We will announce on social media when those are available. Please
welcome
enjoy
to the
this
podcast,
conversation
Becky. Thank you for
Becky
being with
Lloyd
us.
Of Science for Hope.
Thank you so much for me being here. I am honored.
I think we're going to have a fun conversation. You, the last time we spoke, I couldn't get enough. I think it's important probably to say up front that our hope for today's podcast is to really speak to those in the trenches. I think we could do several episodes with you about, you know, different people in the deaf community serving in different ways. But when we think about those in the trenches and struggling and fighting and wanting to do the right thing and wanting to understand all the nuances of what it means to serve vulnerable populations within the deaf community, that's where we'll start today. So would you introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your organization, and how did you end up with TBRI?
Well, I am Becky Lloyd, founder and director of Signs for Hope. TBRI was first on the agenda. Back in 2008, March the 18th, I was driving to school. I had been called back to school by the Lord to get an American Sign Language degree. And I was listening to Family Life Today with Dennis Rainey on the radio.
Okay.
I listened because I have a son, or I had a son who was 19, and he was all in, he's very much attracted to orphans. The radio show that day was geared toward Christian Alliance for Orphans, KFOR.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And so I listened because my son has had a heart for the orphan. And while I was listening, God spoke to me and he said, "I want you to coordinate the adoption of deaf orphans in the world."
Oh, well.
Now that was a shock.
Becky, that sounds like a small task.
Yeah.
Wow. Goodness.
That was a shock. My son happened to be home on spring break that week. And when I got home, I told him what had happened. And he told me, "You tell me when, I'll tell you who." And he told me that I needed to talk with Emily Chapman, Richards Chapman at the time, and to share with her what I had been told. And so this was in March, and it was November before I asked him to tell me to connect me to Emily. So I was in shock. Uh-huh. I had gone back to school for American Sign Language Studies, and interpreting minor, and I was in the last semester of my year. And I had wondered, I said, the Lord knew my experience with adoption, foster care, not personally, but very good friends who had been through this. And I thought, Lord, you have called me to do this. You've got something in mind. And so when I contacted Emily, she directed me to Johnny Carr, who made sure that when I went to CAFO the next year in 2009, that I was connected to Care and Purpose.
Oh, wow.
And so the very first time I heard Care and Purpose, I said, this is it. This is what I need to give parents and anyone else looking to adopt deaf children.
Okay. So that was the beginning. Yes. How did you end up with your organization, and then kind of what's the trajectory been like since 2008?
Well, I was the first to be to do this. I got online and looked at many websites. Many did not have deaf children listed. Rainbow Kids was one that had a few. And then another website had children that were listed that were deaf, but for many years it had been silent. And so I thought, okay, so now what do I do? No one else is doing this. And I've got to figure out what it looks like. And he said, coordinate the adoption of deaf orphans in the world. I had someone tell me, well, you just need to create an agency that represents all the deaf children. And I said, no, that's not what he said. And so I kept listening, and he kept leading. And initially, we were looking to help families connect with deaf children so that they could be adopted. And then he led me to Liberia, West Africa, first and foremost, to see deaf children up close and personal who were orphans. And lo and behold, if he didn't close adoptions 6 months before I got there. Oh. And so I thought, why am I going? And I thought, oh, he made it very clear it was supposed to be Liberia. And so I went, and oh, I found out why. Very quickly, I saw the need. These children had nothing except a bowl of rice a day, sleeping on the floor with disintegrating foam mattresses. And I said, we have to develop a monthly sponsorship for them. And so we did that, and we got most of them sponsored. And then I spent 4 years in Liberia learning about a lot of things. And then Ebola struck.
Oh, man.
And one thing that CAFO did was it kept me on target. It kept me in the scriptures. It kept me looking to God for figuring out what this was to look like. And so I quickly, after about 3 years, recognized that this was coordinate the adoption of deaf orphans in the world, but to coordinate the adoption for his adoption of all of them into his world. So we changed our focus a little bit. I hadn't had that much time to get where I needed to go. I learned for 3.5 years more about adoption, and I had studied the years before. And I don't know, when I started back in school in 2000, I obsessed over the deaf ministry, who is doing what, where, and I wanted to know what is best for the deaf child. And it has taken me a long time to figure that out.
That is a journey. I mean, we talk about the journey in TBRI often, and particularly in our practitioner trainings. And I feel like you are probably still on the journey, obviously, but
yes.
man, what a wild, wild ride. So Samantha Ferris on our team shared with me, she's your training specialist, I believe, and she shared with me some of the documents you guys are kind of putting together and the thoughts and ideas around serving children in the deaf community. Would you share with us before, you know, in TBRI, we talk about kind of the why behind the behavior, and some of that can be developmental issues and some of that can be the trauma and, right, all of those things combine, and then we see this really erratic behavior. Specifically, as we think about the deaf community, what are some things we need to baseline, just very, very baseline, be aware of before we really even begin our TBRI implementation?
I'd say that language deprivation is by far the most important key. And language deprivation is insufficient exposure to adequate stimuli, emotional, social, modeling for holistic natural development of language. So these children have been in the world and they have not had language in the most critical period of life. And so we have to learn what that means. We can't just say, okay, so let's start when they go to school. We can't do that. We have to take them back to that first, the most important part of language, which is eye contact. And we have to help them develop eye contact. Deaf children cannot have language unless they have eye contact. And so we need to create and utilize the different tools for developing eye contact. And this is not a something that is demanded. We earn this right to have eye contact with them. And it has to be done on their timetable.
Yeah. So when we think about the, like you said, language deprivation, and then you said oftentimes, you know, we even discover some of this when they're 4, 5, 6, 7, and so on. How do we even, like, so it's fascinating to me because obviously eye contact is a huge tenet of TBRI, and the fact that that's actually the beginning place, like we know even in the attachment cycle that eye contact matters when we're holding that baby and we're responding to the needs and so on and so forth. But how do we teach people to work with kids that are so far behind in that language development when we're trying to get things back under control? How do we even help them understand that the differences in development because of that missing piece?
Well, at Science for Hope, we have recognized that developmental milestones are key. We have to go back to language first. What is the first development of language? And you go from what an infant got. What did the infant get? They got eye contact. They got interaction. They got so many things that social and emotional foundations. They got attachment. And so we have to start way back there and make sure that we are progressing through every single milestone in order to bring them up to speed.
At what point, like, when's the earliest that a family might know that their child is not hearing?
So hospitals now, not all of them, but some of them have hearing tests before the newborns go home. And so they can find out that way. Sometimes it's missed. Sometimes they are 2 or 3. Before they even recognize it. And, you know, they don't recognize it because they are progressing somewhat as their maybe other, maybe they're a firstborn, but maybe they're a secondborn, and they compare the two. But a firstborn, parents aren't aware of the developmental milestones, and they miss it.
Right, right. Gosh, that's just got to be so hard. How would you encourage families once they find out? I know that when you and I have chatted before, that we've talked about sometimes, like, it's really, really hard for families to figure out what to do. For some reason, there seems to be a missing link between, you know, diagnosis and how do we get language now when we're already behind. And I think when we talked, you were talking about, you know, language is far more than just hearing the words I'm saying. So what if you had something you could tell to professionals working with families or families about, you know, what are some things we could do right when we find out?
Well, first and foremost, even before we find out and we talk about what we would do to help the parents, we have got to develop resources for people to be able to get sign language. Our resources for teaching sign language to parents that is applicable to children is very lacking. And I think we need to develop resources and sign language that can be helpful to parents and what is needed in the home, as opposed to parents and what is needed in a college classroom. You know, I wish I could tell you that there were resources, plethora of resources out there to learn sign language, but there is not. So most of the time, families are having to go to the college campus or the local community college, maybe to a deaf center to learn. But these are not, they're not the best way to learn. I think that teaching in a home setting is the best way. And teaching, you know, signs with the parents as they are learning alongside the children, that has to be done that way. Yes, cochlear implants come into play, but it takes years for children to learn how to speak and how to listen. Cochlear implant does not replace language for very, very long. So having sign language be that base, that foundation, should be something that we can provide for them. And we can't often do that because of where those families are.
I mean, Becky, it is just so, so hard. It just seems like an uphill battle, but what you're discovering is that battle is 100% worth it. And we're thankful to have you in the middle of it, helping all of us understand what our opportunities are. So I'd like to shift and talk, you know, a little bit about the principles of TBRI and how you guys working alongside us are working to, you know, make the necessary adjustments to meet the needs of this community within the framework of TBRI. Obviously, we are highly interested in maintaining fidelity to the model, but we also understand that different communities have different needs. And so let's, if you don't mind, let's kind of walk through each principle just for a couple of minutes, a few minutes, and talk about some of the adjustments that you guys have identified that we need to make or some ways to meet those needs. Let's start with the connecting principles, the heartbeat of TBRI. What are some differences we need to be aware of if we're working within the deaf community and we're trying to connect?
Well, if we're working with deaf children, then we're going to have to work against language deprivation and creating visuals for musing with them is vitally important. We've already talked about eye contact as being one of the most important things. And I would submit that all children that are adopted, or most all children that are adopted, have some language deprivations. And so this might be helpful for all children to develop the eye contact. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you have a child who doesn't know what yes is and what no is and what all those things are. We have to teach those things first and foremost. And learning how to do that in an environment that is a safe environment and not in the moment is very important. We have to practice this with them. We have to give them a thousand different scenarios in order for them to get it. And they're very smart. You're going to find that deaf kids are very smart and they will get things very quickly.
Okay. That's awesome. So within connecting, you talked about eye contact. What about for caregivers, the mindfulness piece, or for professionals, the mindfulness piece? How do we even, it seems like a really complex thing to teach.
Yeah. Well, mindfulness, I think the most important thing for mindfulness is I tell my families when they adopt their children and they bring them in their home, for them to think of that day, that first day, as being their birthday. Don't think how old they are. Think this is the first day that they came into my home, and measure language by that date. Mm-hmm. Measure language by say they've been in your home and they've learned language, sign language, for a year. Say it is 1 year of language. Now, okay. they may not be in target, but at least they're 1 year of language. And so, you know, I think it would be very important for us to do that, no matter how old they are, if they are 10, 12, whatever, when they come home.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, you know, we do talk about throughout TBRI about developmental delays and things like that. But I think with language, it would be particularly challenging when you're working so hard to not try to get ahead of where you are. Right. And I think it's such good advice just to in your head constantly be saying and to be reminding the families we serve that we're really at 6 months. So yeah. What would a child on their 6 month journey of learning language, where would they be? And do we feel comfortable with this? And just, and then I think, you know, we have an opportunity with that level of mindfulness to also support families, but also reduce shame for families, because, you know, we want to fix it. We want to help. We want to give them and give them and give them. And it's a journey, right? And we do have to slow down and really be mindful of kind of the path that we're on, and that a 6 month gain in 6 months is really, really positive, right? We can't get stuck that it's a 10-year-old with a 6 month gain. We have to stay on top of that, you know, like you said, like this measurement of time started 6 months ago, not 10 years and 6 months ago. I really like that. Anything else that really stands out to you for connecting? I think about healthy touch. I imagine if you're not hearing, that touch could be startling and fear-inducing. Are there things that you encourage folks serving in the community to teach specifically around healthy touch?
Well, there is. It's important to touch them and to touch.
Right.
And to they have to get used to you, because they're not going to have been touched at all unless they're grabbed. So, you know, they don't have language in the orphanage. And so they have survived in the orphanage because they have learned what people like and what people don't like. And so how we touch them is very important. What you need to remember is, in order to sign, our hands have to be free. And their eyes have to be on us in order for them to get what we're signing. Now, hearing kids don't have to look at us to get what we're trying to talk to say to them. But deaf kids have to look at us in order to get what it is they're wanting to be understood. So, you know, you think about those hands. Well, my hands are busy signing. I can't touch when I'm signing. So you take the time to touch, and then you sign. And you take the time to touch, and then you sign.
You know, I mean, gosh, just such tiny things that we can do, but it takes an awareness of knowing that. And I think we can get busy and forget to take the pause to get the healthy touch in. We know it's important. We know it's valuable. We know it calms the stress system. We've all, I think, been exposed to how, you know, we get permission for touch and things like that. But just the idea of, like, you wouldn't have to pause in a verbal conversation to give healthy touch, or, you know, a fist bump or high five or a hug or any of that. And so I appreciate you just even pointing out that little difference of, like, you give healthy touch and then you sign, and you give healthy touch and then you sign, like, but you have to pause to include it. And it's so important. It's so important, because that's a healing moment, right? What about the empowering principles? We think about, let's start with maybe the physiological strategies with the body and empowering the body. Any differences that we need to be aware of as we approach meeting those needs?
Yeah. Sensory needs are going to be very common for these children.
Okay.
The fact that they can't hear, you know, it's, well, if you think about it, let's say at nighttime when it's dark, and let's say something happened at nighttime when it's dark. Well, hearing kids can hear something coming. Deaf kids cannot. So hypervigilance is very high for deaf children.
Okay.
Yeah, especially at nighttime. So
makes so, you know, much sense.
Yeah. You know, they can't hear trouble coming, so they have to keep their eyes open in order to see it coming.
So how are there ways that we can specifically create felt safety during those times?
I believe that creating and helping the children understand that they are safe is by leaving lights on in their rooms so they can see enough. There's some different things that we've had different parents use, different things. So many different light sources and lights to keep them aware of what is going on so that they can feel safe and can fall asleep.
Okay. It makes so much sense, but it's like a whole different level of felt safety that we're trying to build. When you said, you know, they can't hear if something's, you know, if there's a loud noise that happens or something like that. And I think, like, gosh, I mean, of course their hypervigilance is through the roof. And, but it's almost hard to explain that, right? Like for a hearing child who hears a loud noise and is startled or afraid, we can provide felt safety through explanation, right? Like we can just simply explain that was this, or this is what happened, or a book fell off the counter, you know, whatever it was. But the complete absence of that, and how you would have to try to keep yourself safe, would be a whole nother level of creating, like, a really predictable environment. In my mind, stepping outside of my norm, like, we wouldn't leave the lights on when we're sleeping. That would be bothersome to us. And so, like, really taking a look into what is this experience like for this child, and what is a normal expectation that we should have, that nighttime is going to be scary. So we have to be thoughtful. That is so powerful. In particular, the connecting principles, I want to drill down just a little bit into, because there's a lot that's going on, right? We're bringing in empowering, we're bringing in felt safety, we're bringing in connecting, we're bringing in planning and organizing our thoughts and our day and our activities and our responses. Within the ideal response alone, we're, you know, I feel like it could be complex, a little bit different in some ways with the deaf community. How do you guys approach that?
We do, again, has to have visuals and we have to be able to show and not tell what is going on. We have to be able to it's just going to take a whole lot longer. And so I think if we recognize with the ideal response that it's going to take time and just take that time.
Okay.
It's just going to take time.
Right. And when we think about the levels of response, you know, embedded in the ideal response, one of the notes I saw that y'all had in the document that you're working on is, well, there were two or three notes. But one of them was to like actually intentionally get into the child's line of sight.
Yes.
And, as a hearing person, we wouldn't always go to that step first. Right. And so just coaching, our professionals and our families, little things, slowing down your signing, right?
Yes.
Because we know that like when we think about voice tone and cadence for the hearing community, how do we translate that into the deaf community? That means we actually have to move slower with our signs mm-hmm. because we could be dysregulating just with our sign language is my assumption. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And what's interesting is, it's very cultural for deaf people to have facial expressions that look like they're mad mm-hmm. when they sign. That's not the case. It looks that way to hearing people. Mm-hmm. It looks that way to a deaf child that comes from a hearing orphanage who has gotten hearing expressions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you first bring a deaf child into your home, try your best to have a pleasant expression on your face.
Mm-hmm.
It is hard if you're a good signer and you've done your due diligence to sign ASL, mm-hmm. you're going to have to change that face in order for it to be accepted and them not to be afraid of you.
My niece was going through interpretation classes locally here, and one of them was on the expressions that
yes.
that you make in tandem with sign language mm-hmm. and I remember like she was trying to teach my daughter some of the signs and stuff, and I was like, why do you look so mad? And she was like, no, you're just, it's different expressions offer different mm-hmm. emphasis, and it's mm-hmm. you know, could be the exclamation point, it could be the period. Like she was like, you know, you're just, we're limited. We don't have tone. We don't have, you know, a lot of these other things that we use in the hearing world to accentuate our communication. We use facial expressions. And I had never thought about all the complexities around that and how important it is. But in my mind, that's what I kept thinking. You look mad. And she's like, I didn't say anything mad. I was just expressing, it was a grizzly. I don't know what she said, but I'm thinking like, you know, grizzly bear or something, but you know, I think it's so important, and what a trick it would be if you're fluent in American Sign Language
yes.
to adjust your facial expressions. I mean, that's like learning a new language almost, and so or at least an adjustment within. And but what a great awareness to have, because mm-hmm. if the kids would interpret that the wrong way until they learn ASL.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Any other thoughts around the correcting principles and proactive teaching? I know you've said we explain eye contact, but what is even in that proactive teaching of things like the importance of eye contact with the child? What does mm-hmm. that look like?
Well, you know, we don't explain eye contact to the child. We do it like moms do it with infants. They catch them looking at them and they smile. They play peekaboo with them. They play anything that gets them to look at them and they smile. And so, you know, that smiling is what gets them to see that we are safe. And yes, it takes a long time, but it is worth it.
So it's similar in my mind to when you were talking about, you know, day one of placement is day one of language. That day one, whether it's a 10-year-old or a 3-year-old, you're really starting day one like you have an infant in a lot of the regards of teaching these skills. And how have you had kids that are resistant to it? Because
sure.
I would think 10-year-olds sure. aren't like, what the heck are you doing playing peekaboo with me? Mm-hmm. I would think they do not mm-hmm. think that's super fun. Do you have any recommendations for people that are working with older kids who have had experiences that, you know, might create some resistance to this work that we're trying to do?
Yeah. First and foremost, every child is different. And so you're going to get a different response from every child.
Okay.
With a 10-year-old, they might be inclined to look at you. They're going to realize at some age, I don't know what age, they will realize that they are dependent on visual as being their communication. Mm-hmm. Even though they don't communicate with sign language, they understand that they get things visually.
Okay.
So a 10-year-old might get it that he needs to look at his mom for language. It all depends on how much else is going on. Mm-hmm. And just being able to say that a 10-year-old would look to you for language. No, I can't say that.
Okay.
It depends on what else is going on. But yes, they might at some point recognize that the visual is what they're depending on for communication, not for language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Man, it's just like, it's like everything else. We want like a cookie cutter recipe that mm-hmm. will give us exactly what to do. And like we tell everybody else, no matter who they're serving, you know, we are meeting individual needs at the time that the needs pop up with respect to the developmental stage that the child is in. Becky, if you could give us one piece of advice for folks working with the deaf community, what would it be?
Let them lead you. If you're working in the deaf community, let them lead you. They know what it's like. Don't assume that we know what is best for them. Don't take the thought of, well, I know this has got to be better because you haven't done this. Mm-hmm. Just because they're deaf doesn't mean they have any less understanding of things. They haven't had exposure to things, but you know, the deaf are brilliant, and I have been blown away by what they have and what they bring to me. And I have a lot to learn, and I can learn only from the deaf community.
Boy, isn't that the truth. Mm-hmm. Becky, you are a delight, and we are so thankful that you came on the podcast to share your wisdom and your perspective and your knowledge. I know that I am for sure way behind, but I've really enjoyed learning from you and I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation about how we can serve this particular community. So thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
The TBRI podcast is produced by the Care and Purpose Institute of Child Development at TCU. To learn more about TBRI and the resources mentioned in this episode, please visit child.tcu.edu/podcast.